Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was such a rarity, and it's becoming something like a drumbeat. Stories of Muslim Americans drawn to extremism and to purveyors of violence. Not a wave, but a drumbeat. The five arrests in Pakistan, terror charges against Najibullah Zazi, a Chicagoan accused of helping plant tax in Mumbai, Minnesotans in hard Islamist company in Somalia, the questions around Fort Hood. No one's more on edge about it than Muslim Americans themselves. This hour on Point, national security, alienation, and tensions in the Muslim American community. You can join the conversation. What is going on here and why? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will hear later in this hour from an imam working with young Muslim Americans. Joining me first from Washington is Alejandro Butel, government liaison for the Muslim Public Affairs Council. He's just authored a big report on radicalization and how to combat it. He's been an active Muslim youth leader. Alejandro, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
And from Washington, Juan Carlos Zarate joins us, senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's also a security analyst for CBS. From 2005 to 2009, he served as deputy assistant to the president and deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism. Juan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you, Tom. I appreciate being on.
So we've got Juan and Alejandro in an hour about Islam. We are a very multicultural society, and it's a beautiful thing. And I have to say right off the bat, I mean, this is the last show on earth I ever wanted to be doing, you know, ever since 9/11, this show and many others have worked very hard to see this country as a whole and to embrace all of its communities, very much including the Islamic American community. So, I mean, we don't want to give this too much emphasis, but we don't want to give it too little. We want to face it quite squarely. Alejandro Butel, what do you see going on here? You've got now newspapers across the country publishing these lists of, you know, David Headley, the Pakistani-born American in Chicago, involved with the plot against a Danish newspaper and involved in the planning for the attacks in Mumbai, and 14 people charged in Minnesota with recruiting kids in the U.S. to train and fight with terror groups in Somalia. And, you know, right on down, Tariq Mehana arrested outside Boston. Najibullah Zazi, we know he served, you know, like coffee on Wall Street, but then charged with planning bombing attacks in the U.S. and on. What do you make of this drumbeat, Alejandro?
I think the first thing is to really emphasize that speaking for the, looking at it from American Muslim perspective, one act of violent extremism is one too many, and that there is a growing realization among our leadership that these things need to be dealt with more squarely. Now, as you mentioned before, we can't ignore it. Neither can we blow it out of proportion too much, because either way is counterproductive. But certainly, though, the fact that these things are taking place is a challenge for our communities and a cause for concern. And where this is one of the reasons why we came out with a report is to learn how to tackle this issue in a multifaceted approach.
And we have leaders in the Muslim American community now. Of course, the five in Pakistan, it was family members who first brought this to the attention of authorities, what might be going on there. We have Muslim American leaders coming out and saying, you know what? We hate to say it, but we may have an alienation problem in some parts of our community. How would you describe that problem, Alejandro?
Well, I certainly think that a lot of these individuals, even before going into that, I would say that I would like to offer both my condolences and commend the family for stepping forward at the same time.
Yes.
for doing this, because I think it was a courageous act. But also, though, shows that Muslim Americans are continuing to renew their moral commitment to this country, both based on their faith and their desire to be integrated here into the U.S. Mm. As for the individuals themselves and what have been a string of arrests lately, I think it's important to also keep in mind that the profiles of many of these individuals, many are on the fringes, and they don't necessarily neatly fit into one specific profile that even other terrorism experts have recognized. So I think it's a little premature to call it a trend. And being that a lot of these cases are pending, we need to wait for the facts to come out. But even so, irrespective of all of this, again, one case of violent extremist activity within our community is one too many.
Juan Carlos Zarate, we have Janet Napolitano in a speech in New York just in the last few days talking about homegrown terrorism. She says, and not just Islamic America, but she says we've seen an increased number of arrests here in the U.S. of individuals suspected of plotting terrorist attacks or supporting terror groups abroad, such as Al-Qaeda. Home-based terrorism is here, and like violent extremism abroad, it will be part of the threat picture that we must now confront. Juan, do you agree? And what's driving this?
Well, Tom, I do agree. And I think what's troubling about the recent arrests is the fact that you have more individuals and second, third-generation Americans who are not only radicalized but who are reaching out to these known terrorist organizations abroad. The Headley case, I think, is extremely disturbing.
This is the Pakistani-American born to a, what, Pakistani diplomat father and American mother who helped plan Mumbai.
Exactly, and didn't fit many of the profiles. 49 years old, did research for Lashkar-e-Taiba, the Kashmiri terrorist group that perpetrated the Mumbai attacks, was casing other sites, was involved in planning on a Danish newspaper abroad. And so
after they published the cartoon showing Muhammad with bombs in his turban.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so this is a disturbing evolution of the threat. We, of course, before this recent slate of arrests, have seen a number of these cases: Jose Padilla, Derek Sharif, the Fort Dix plot, Ayman Faris, the Lackawanna Six. You know, many of these, in some ways, were dismissed as perhaps overstatements by the Bush administration or by the FBI. But I think we're part of a trend of converts and maybe naturalized citizens engaged in violent extremist activity.
But a lot of those ended up being sort of dry holes, it seemed, or, you know, they seemed less there than met the eye at first. Might that still be the case here, Juan?
Well, I think so, and I think Alejandro makes a good point that I think we need to reserve judgment on proclaiming any grand trends here. I think we are looking at a number of serious cases, important cases, North Carolina included, where individuals were involved in a plot against Quantico and in overseas activities. And so there's a number of these pending. But again, I think what's most troubling is that you've got more of these cases emerging. You've got some of these individuals acting in groups like the five Pakistani-Americans who are alleged to have gone abroad to commit terrorist acts, and they are trying to connect with known terrorist organizations, which makes their activity all the more dangerous.
Alejandro here, I'm looking at Zeno Baran at the Hudson Institute saying people focused, that is before, on the idea that we're different, we're better at integrating Muslims than Europe is, for example. He says, but there's radicalization, especially among converts and newcomers, such as the Somali case shows. He says, I think young U.S. Muslims today are as prone to radicalization as Muslims in Europe. That is a long way from where this country has historically stood, Alejandro. Do you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely not. I think that the United States has a much better position in terms of integrating its Muslim American community than most European states. And there are a number of different reasons why. But by and large, when we look at a lot of the indicators for integration, such as education levels, income levels, Muslim American communities do far better than European Muslims do. And again, the profiles of the individuals themselves in these strings of cases, most of these individuals are on the fringes. Now, when we talk about, for instance, issues of converts, newcomers, a lot of these individuals are what I would call belonging to vulnerable populations that are addressed in our report. And essentially what we say is that in our report, Muslim American community needs to step up its efforts by engaging in various kinds of outreach, social programming, social welfare, reaching and connecting, talking about various sensitive topics, basically to make sure that these individuals are inoculated against any sort of radical ideas, but also, though, that they can make sure that their faith is relevant to the society that they live in and that they don't feel marginalized or that they're going through any sort of an identity crisis, which puts them in these very vulnerable positions.
Alejandro, what drives or maybe what feeds alienation when and if it's there?
That's a very, very, very complex question. But a lot of it has to do with whether internally or outside of the community. In some cases, youth or converts may feel like they don't have people that can connect to. And so they're kind of left hanging at times. In other cases, externally, there might be cases of discrimination and a feeling of alienation by the larger American community. Although, again, by and large, the United States has done a lot better job than Europe has, but that doesn't mean that there still aren't challenges that face our community externally as well.
Juan Carlos Zarate, I mean, you know, one of the things that you hear coming out of some of these cases is, whatever the motivation, the year after year of seeing American troops in Muslim countries abroad can be hard on some American Muslims, just to see it, just to watch it.
No, I think that's right, Tom, and I think a lot of experts right now are scratching their heads to look at the factors that are maybe compelling some of these individuals or affecting these individuals. I think the reality is, and we have to be quite conscious of this, that in the post 9/11 environment, the media, the internet has been saturated with the narrative that Al-Qaeda and extremists have wanted to perpetrate, which is and to permeate in the media, which is that the U.S. is at war with Islam. You've got examples of that with troops on the ground in Muslim-majority countries, that it's the duty of every good Muslim to defend Muslims around the world, and that there's a religious obligation to do so. That's the simple narrative. And the reality is that that's had an attraction around the world and has had an attraction and has started to have an attraction here at home.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about national security, alienation, and tension in the Islamic American community over a spate of Muslim Americans apparently drawn to extremist messages and acts. Alejandro Butel is with us from the Muslim American Public Affairs Council in Washington. He's authored a big report on radicalization and how to combat it. Juan Carlos Zarate is with us. He's a senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, served as deputy assistant to the president, that would be George W. Bush, and deputy national security advisor for combating terrorism from 05 to 09. We'll be joined in just a moment by an imam who works with young Muslim Americans in this country. Let's get a call right here from Dearborn, Michigan. Andre. Andre, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you think?
What troubles me, my friend, is that when the Irish Americans were here and they had the IRA going on in Ireland,
yes,
they weren't called terrorists. They were just criminals. It's just criminals. Why do they call criminals terrorists? It's overkill. It's saturated. I don't believe anything. I don't believe none of the speculation at all, Tom. They don't call the IRA Catholics here terrorists. Why are we getting blamed for this madness, Tom? I think it's really wrong, and I'm not worried about it at all.
Let's talk about it, Andrea. I'm very interested in your perspective. Yes, there absolutely was large Irish support in this country for a lot of things that went on in Ireland, and some of those did get labeled terrorism. People may not like it, but over the years, at points, that did come out. But are you saying that there is something criminal going on, Andre, going on here?
I think when the government starts calling criminals terrorists, then we make a big mistake. That was the same mistake, Tom, we made after 9/11. We should have just called them criminals and not terrorists.
What do you make of the five guys out of Virginia that went to Pakistan? The Pakistani government says, you know, they were looking to join Islamic extremists there. What do you make of that story? Are you Muslim, Andre?
Yes, I am. I don't know what to make of that. I don't know if that's propaganda or disinformation, mm-hmm. but I call that potential criminal activity. Why do we have to label everything as terrorism? It changes the whole mindset.
Hey, I hear you loud and clear. Alejandro Butel, let me come first to you on that. How should we be describing what's going on here?
Actually, I would have to agree with Andre. In the sense that it points to something in terms of how we discuss the issue of terrorism itself. I actually agree that we should be labeling them as criminals as opposed to as anything else, simply because it gives them a greater sense of importance than they really deserve. And I'm not the only one that shares this view. For mm-hmm. instance, former FBI counterterrorism agent Michael German, who has enormous expertise in this, also agrees and says the same thing. We shouldn't be giving them a hand by calling them jihadists. We shouldn't be giving them a hand by even calling them Muslim terrorists, or even terrorists for that matter, because that sort of thing feeds into their own propaganda machine. Now, as for whether or not these arrests are some sort of disinformation or propaganda, again, looking at the way that things have been, I would take a more circumspect view and say that this is something that needs to be closely examined. Again, we're not going to be trying them in the court of public opinion, but rather in the court of law. But there is definitely some level of concern here.
I want to be careful to point out that what we're talking about here is trying to focus on, is there alienation? If so, why? What can be done about it? Is there radicalization, which can follow right. alienation in any community? If so, what is it? And what can be done about it? And, of course, we have seen that at the end of that pipeline, terrorism can emerge. I mean, it has in many different ethnic conflicts and religious conflicts Absolutely. Over time, including this one. So it's not as though it's off the table, but it's certainly not all that's on the table. Permit me, if you would, I'd like to bring another voice into this conversation from Washington, D.C. We're joined now by Imam Mahdi Bray. He's a civic activist, grassroots leader, works closely with Muslim American youth across the country, serves as executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation. It's a Washington-based advocacy group. Imam Mahdi Bray, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom, and thank you for having me.
What do you see going on? You work with young Muslim Americans. What are they being exposed to? What are the currents in the news, in the culture, that may be pushing some of them into alienation?
Well, I think certainly we need to put it in context. First of all, young people are very passionate, you know, in adolescency, in their teen years, and young adult years. And some of the same salient factors that give you gangbangers, that give you skinheads and neo-Nazi group youth activities, or, you know, religious fanaticism or religious extremist situations involving young Muslims are across the board. And some of them have to deal with dysfunctionality in families that it crosses economic line. Sometimes, you know, mom and dad, you know, might be providing a wonderful income, but not providing the type of attention that young people need. I think certainly the other thing is a sense of alienation often, in particular with Muslims, in terms of what they see happening here at home and abroad. Discrimination, the whole concept of the ongoing wars that are taking place and the carnage that's taking place in the Muslim world. So you see all of these factors, as well as sometimes a need to belong. And, you know, I've looked at some of the stuff that's taking place on the Internet, and it really does bring about a certain sense of camaraderie and closeness and things of those nature. And those are the same type of tools that gangbangers, you know, recruitment use, the same things that these other negative antisocial influences use. And so I think that these are some important things that we really, really need to look at. But I think also it's very important for those who are doing youth work in the American Muslim community to really not abdicate the issue of responding to what I call the seductive but destructive narrative on the Internet by religious extremists, that we have to be in place. And that's one of the new projects that we're really involved and engaged in called Straight Path, where we're actually going to be more involved on the Internet and trying to combat, if you will, or at least respond, you know, in a proactive way to what I call the negative narrative that often leads young people into some really horrible, bad decisions in their young age.
Imam Mahdi Bray, let me ask you. I mean, yeah, you're quite right. I mean, we, as a society, we push back against and try and deal with gangbangers, skinheads, neo-Nazis. We understand that these can be kids in trouble. We try and influence them away from that. Maybe the same here. But what about what you've seen on the Internet? I mean, one of these five young men who ended up in Pakistan, I think you knew glancingly at least. The news is that among the things that they had were, you know, some of these videos showing American military in big trouble in different settings. These are very common Islamic extremist videos showing, American military getting, you know, beat up, shot up, you name it. How is this extremist movement working on the Internet, and what's the appeal of it? How does it draw kids in?
Well, it comes across in very different ways. The first, in some parts, it really plays to, for lack of a better word, just male machismo, you know. Also, it comes across sometimes in within the subtext of the hip-hop culture, so you're talking about jihad cool, you know. And
jihad cool.
Mm. Yeah. And then the other thing is it sometimes it can be very, very seductive in terms of pulling what I would say people who would not be predisposed to any type of activity like this. For instance, I've seen one where it starts off talking about interfaith, you know, the respect to have for other people within the various different other faith communities, and and how we have to respect humanity, and it starts off in that way, and that's very logical. That's very within keeping of the correct understanding of Islam, and then it gradually moves towards. But when we see circumstances happening, like we see in Gaza, like we see in Afghanistan, like we see in Iraq, then we have to do something, and then it moves towards, you know, trying to get people to move in what I call extremist circles, or try to recruit people to respond in inappropriate manners, which also highlights another aspect.
Mm-hmm.
Young people see things that are wrong in the world. Young Muslims see social and economic injustice in the world, and we don't want them to be indifferent to these type of things.
Of course.
Nor should they be.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the important way is to find methods and that are done through with young people to be able to address these issues. I think this is one of the challenges, you know, being an old head or an elder or old school to come to young kids, you know, coming out of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the great challenges in the civil rights movement. How do you address segregation and racial bigotry without going into burning down your own community and things of that nature?
Is it going to be Black Panther or Martin Luther King?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. so I think that certainly that these are some of the critical things that we're facing. So,
do you feel outgunned by the media push by extremists on the internet, Imam?
I don't feel so much outgunned as I think that we were just late in the process. I think that certainly as we continue to go forward with our program like Straight Path, this is something that we're going to roll out in December in Chicago at our annual conference, that we'll be able to bring forth people that have what we call street credentials, people like Mos Def, the Muslim actor, or Akeem Olajuwon, Cat Stevens, now known as Yusuf Islam, doing these 30 and 60-second kind of PSAs, if you will, on the internet, podcasts, and stuff like that, really talking to people about, the importance of, dealing and staying away from extremist points of views. That's why we call it Straight Path, which is taken from the Quran wording, Surat al-Mustaqim. So that's one of the aspects, and we feel that that's going to get a lot of, kind of play. We're talking about setting up blogs and websites all across America. I just think that basically that youth work within the Muslim community internally has been about moderation. But I think that we were out of step with the medium, and so now we have to catch up with the medium. So we're playing catch-up. I don't think so much outgun as we're playing catch-up. I just think that we really have to hit the ground running and very effectively respond to the negative narrative that is jeopardizing our youth.
Juan Carlos Zarate in Washington, there is there's a kind of a message battle here. There's also a law enforcement battle here. How do you see those two working? Do they work in concert?
They work in concert, but they can also work against each other. I think one of the things that the various communities of interest should be commended for is the outreach that they've done along with the FBI. I think the case of the Somali Americans in Minneapolis, where families have been working with the FBI to figure out how to stop the flow of young Somali Americans into East Africa, has been very important.
Mm.
The same thing with the families of the five Pakistani Americans coming forth asking for help. I think, one of the keys here is to view this ideological battle and the threat to our youth as a collective battle. And I think too often in the past we have viewed a divide between government and communities. And to your caller's previous point, I think have been a little bit in denial about the nature of the ideology, the allure it has, and the danger of creating divisions in our society. And I think your other guests should be commended for the work they're doing now I think it's important and revolutionary work to actually engage in countering the ideology and in dealing with, as Imad mentioned, the jihadi cool aspects of the ideology that really does have resonance in some parts of our country and certainly other parts of the world. And so I see a convergence of interests here, and I think we need to find other and better ways of working together.
Let me get a call right here from Sac City, Iowa. Bill, you're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom, and thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
You don't hear the Muslim community, I believe, on a large scale coming out vehemently against Islamic extremism. Sure, you know, there are token condemnations and some work in this area that you occasionally hear about. However, I think they have to work hard to create an atmosphere where this type of Islamic extremism just doesn't occur as rapidly as it is starting to happen now. And I believe it's just a matter of time that we're going to have a major attack in this country, and then I think we'll finally get it. But I think the Muslim community has to work much harder, and it has to become more apparent to the rest of the citizens in this country.
Bill, let us pick it up, and thank you for your call. Alejandro Butel, first to you. I mean, this is something that is not uncommonly heard. Why aren't Muslim leaders speaking up more forcefully when these things happen? Are we missing the message, or could there, should there be some louder pushback? Is there some difficulty in pushing back or speaking up?
In some cases, it's missing the message. In other cases, though, there is both a quality and a quantity challenge within our community to address this issue. Quantity in the sense that we do need to do much more, and quality in the sense that it has to go beyond the outreach. Now, Imam Mahdi Bray before had talked about the Straight Path program. MPAC, for instance, since 2005, has had its national grassroots campaign to fight terrorism. In addition to that, we're also trying to channel youth productivity into doing things like civic engagement. We're going to debut our I Am Civic Engagement campaign in 35 cities across the country. And this is going to basically take the productive, creative energies of youth and other individuals and put it into engaging the civic process, not just to help our communities, but the broader country as a whole.
Imam Mahdi Bray, if Muslim leaders become very upfront saying this is bad, condemning all this, do they risk alienating their own youth?
No, I don't think so, because I think that that's not really where the weakness is, and I think we have to be really objective in assessing what our weaknesses are. I think one of the things we need to look at is a paradigm shift within the Muslim community in terms of what being involved with youth involves. I think often what we have is a good old boys network whereby young people are kind of given tasks like, you know, babysitting for functions, moving chairs and things of that nature.
Right.
And as a result of that, no, young people are not having a buy-in. You're going to have to engage young people more effectively in the mosque itself, at the board level, mentoring and processes of leadership and things of that nature, and not just treating them as kids. And also, they have to have a buy-in. You can't have a 70-year-old or a 60-year-old or a 50-year-old design youth programs and expect young people to be all thrilled about it. You know, in order to get a tie-in, you know, then you have to have a buy-in. So young people will only buy in if they feel that they're part of the process, and that makes sense. So there has to be a sense of ownership of the programs that are being, you know, done in terms of many of our mosques. Many of our mosques really feel that just simply keeping young people busy with sports activities, good kind of religious training,
is
Sunday school, all that needs to be done.
Yeah,
but there's a lot more that needs to be done, and one of the things is that you really have to allow young people to find their place in the sun in terms of being involved in leadership in the community.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about national security, alienation, and tension in the Islamic American community after a spate of Muslim Americans in the news apparently drawn to extremist messages. This after many years, decades, where Muslim Americans were seen as the world's Muslims kind of exempt from the appeal of the extremist message, solid American citizens, and it's still the center of gravity here. But there's something going on, and we're looking at it this hour with Imam Mahdi Bray. He joins us from Washington, civic activist, works with a lot of youth. They're executive director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation. Alejandro Butello, the Muslim Public Affairs Council, is with us. And Juan Carlos Zarate is here from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Let's get a call from April in Beverly, Massachusetts. April, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a question for the imam, more something he can speak to. As an outsider, as a non-Muslim looking in, it sort of seems like there's a separation between Muslims with African-American roots opposed to Muslims with Middle Eastern roots. And how is that culture, subculture different for the kids? Are the churches separate? Does everybody worship together? So maybe you can just speak to that whole dynamic.
We'll go straight to it. Imam Mahdi Bray, what do you say?
Well, certainly there have been two kind of enclaves within the Muslim community, those that are referred to as the indigenous, those who were actually converts or many within the African-American community, as well as those that came, you know, and migrated to this country as immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And certainly I think that there has been a tremendous gulf, but I think that gulf is closing with the generational aspect. Certainly my kids are a lot different in terms of coalescing and working with other Muslims than perhaps my experiences were initially in terms of converting to Islam. So I think that the generational aspects of it actually brings things closer together in terms of our young people. But I think that that's also reflective in the entire demographics of America and period, that there is a more coming together of racial people. Being a product of the 50s
sure.
and 60s, I remember how people, you know, kind of segregated themselves based on race, you know, and it's not as systemic, you know, in America as it was maybe in the 50s, 60s, 70s, or even the 80s for that point of view. And so I think the same thing is happening in the American Muslim community. It's a reflection of what's happening in the greater society. Our kids go to school together. They worship together. Certainly, there are certain areas where there's a predominant maybe of one particular ethnic group, and they will probably dominate, you know, the attendance at a particular mosque. But on basis, I would just say that I think that the integration process internally among the Muslim community is increasing and moving in the correct direction, I think.
A kind of convergence, there.
Absolutely.
Let's get a couple
of
more calls. Chris in Ithaca, New York. Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you.
Hi, Chris.
Tom, hello. This
Hi.
Is Chris in sunny Ithaca. This comes back to alienation on the whole thing. And I think we're making a big mistake when we're trying to see a system of recruitment and propaganda. We're negating the individual experience. And for that, I'll give you an example. Mm. Dr. Hassan, for example, Fort Hood?
The Fort Hood shooter, killer, yes.
Right. His parents came from a small farming community. They were farmers east of Jerusalem in what's known as the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
Those people are really attached to the land. His parents are dead. But without a doubt, his family history and his communication, individual communication, not on the Internet, not webs, probably, hypothesis only, probably raised his consciousness of the injustice towards Palestinians, for example, and the injustice against Muslims. And then, of course, he has his own problem with the people discriminating against him, calling him names and so forth, even in the military, which is supposed to be...
But what's your point there, Chris, that his own family's history would logically lead him to massacre 13 people? I mean, is that...
His own family history plus all these others.
But still, that's quite a step. Even if somebody had political concerns and sympathies that were difficult, or, I mean, he heard a lot of war stories as well and reportedly, you know, complained about what he was hearing there. But you're saying what? There's more. There are personal stories at work here.
Every one of these individuals is a personal history. We're trying to say no. These are innocent guys. They were ignorant until some propaganda machine took them over.
We'll raise it. We'll look at just that question, Chris. And I appreciate your call. Let me get one more right here from Milford, Connecticut. Valerie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think going back to the perception that the United States is at war with Islam, I think there is no action that would suggest to the international Muslim community that our country is at war with Islam more than the war in Iraq. The international Muslim community must have looked at our invasion of Iraq as a war against Islam, because I think any thinking Muslim knew that there was no way that Saddam Hussein or Iraq was involved in 9/11.
Well, but I mean, you could portray it that way, and many have. On the other hand, you know, Saddam Hussein, on his own terms, was a dictator, and there's that dynamic as well. He was killing a lot of his own people.
There are many, many, many dictators in the world who are killing their own people. And I think if you just look at it from the external international mm-hmm. Muslim community and Muslim in the United States, you would have to scratch your head and say, why, when 5,000 Americans were killed by Al-Qaeda, did we suddenly switch gears and invade Iraq? Why?
Valerie,
I scratched my head and said it myself as a non-Muslim, so I can certainly understand how Muslims worldwide would question that. So I'm just suggesting that our actions in foreign policy in the first decade of the new millennium did a lot to create an impression that we are at war with Islam.
Let us pick it up, Valerie, and I thank you for your call. Alejandro Butel, I'll come first to you on that point. We'll get to Chris's point as well, but what about the message? It's on many Islamist websites. U.S. is at war with Islam. Does that sell in the United States? Is that persuasive? And what about Valerie's point? The U.S. foreign policy can't be ignored in understanding the psychology of what's going on here.
Okay. Both very, very good questions. Regarding the perception issue, this is actually something that we discuss at detail in the report itself. It references a different report that I actually had worked on a couple of months prior to that, where I did a quantitative study of Osama bin Laden's statements from 1996 until 2009. And in that study, what we found, myself and my co-author, Dr. Imaduddin Ahmed, what we found is that overwhelmingly, when Osama bin Laden tries to address certain audiences, he always plays on the theme of policy grievances in order to create the narrative that people are now talking about that can give some allure to individuals. So he talks about it, and by a 51-to-1 ratio of policies versus religious justification, he uses policies much more. Mm-hmm. And so while a lot of people will say that there's a theological element to it, and yes, it is, it's not necessarily one of the main drivers. There's a humongous policy element that feeds into the narrative and gives it a certain level of credibility that it might not otherwise have.
We've heard testimony over the years that U.S. foreign policy could create as many terrorists as it subtracts.
Well, there certainly is counterproductive foreign policy. As to whether or not they can have some sort of gravitas here in the U.S., the fact, again, that this is not Europe definitely helps to provide an inoculation against any sort of widespread extremism.
Why?
However, there will still be fringe elements within our community that it will appeal to, and we have to be very, very concerned and very, very vigilant about it.
Why has it been a less hospitable to receptivity for these messages than Europe? Why?
Because the United States, with its respect for religious freedom and the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, allows people to live out the American dream. Even if I was to look at it from a counterterrorism standpoint for a moment, our Constitution is perhaps the greatest counterterrorism strategy on the face of the earth, whereby the Bill of Rights itself tells the government, hey, you need to focus on criminal activity and not round up the individuals, and thereby you make sure that your efforts are focused, efficient, and not giving terrorists any sort of ideological ammunition to help their ranks grow.
Well, Juan Carlos Zarate, what about our caller Chris saying that we should not see a system of recruitment and propaganda here, that these are individual, personal stories, maybe of grievance, leading to, you know, ways of thinking or to actions? Is there a system at work as well?
Well, he raises a good point, because I think we tend to overgeneralize when we talk about radicalization and the ideology. And I think there are gradations based on individual circumstances, you know, people who are involved because they want to be part of this jihadi cool atmosphere, others who want to dabble in potential plots, others who are more committed, want to fight abroad. others who form part of the inner core, thinking back to Adam Gadan, the convert who's now part of Al-Qaeda's central command. And so I think we do need to be careful about overgeneralizing. And I think the issues of radicalization, as Imad had mentioned, you know, often relate to individual circumstances, and we need to be conscious of that. That said, it's tied into, and this is what makes it dangerous, it's tied into this broader global movement and this broader narrative. And to your caller's, second caller's point, the reality is Al-Qaeda uses each and every grievance and any semblance of truth that matches their narrative to their advantage, whether it's Iraq, Afghanistan, Chechnya, Gaza, you name it. They rely on it, including the mortgage crisis. You know, Bin Laden has talked about the economy and sort of global grievances against the economic order. So, you know, this is a movement that is trying to frame this narrative, frame a global movement, and frankly, they deny the reality that the U.S. has done quite a bit for Muslim countries, more aid going to Muslim-majority countries than any other country in the world, come to the defense of Muslims in Bosnia, Kuwait, part of the Mujahideen movement itself in the 1980s against the Soviets. And so these are things that go largely ignored in the narrative and that we need to keep in mind when we tend to fall prey to kind of the heckler's veto, trying to give too much credence to the arguments that we should temper our policies simply because the other guys will use it against us.
It's a complex, compelling picture. Let's get a call from Omaha, Nebraska. Tasmin. Tasmin, you're on the air.
I'd like to specifically say assalamu alaikum to the elder imam. I'm calling from Omaha, Nebraska. I'm actually a native of Los Angeles, California. And this has kind of guided my perspective insofar as this is concerned. Basically, as a Muslim youth, at a certain point in my life, I'm not currently a practicing Muslim, but as a Muslim youth, we do not have far to look insofar as grievances are concerned. Al-Qaeda and these other organizations, even without their influence, the fact remains that there's a certain hypocrisy inherent in the statement that we should look to America as some sort of beacon for equality and religious fairness. The fact is that we're engaged in wars of aggression. The fact is that we are still maintaining these camps in Guantanamo. The fact is that many Muslim women, children, and elders die in an attempt for us to spread our so-called democracy worldwide. And for us to persist in kind of creating this guise for these Muslim youth as if, oh, no, we're very fair, and you're just confused about the nature of the argument, that is where the inherent problem is. If we really want to pursue gaining these youth and making them legitimate American citizens in their belief and their behavior, then we must address our foreign policy issue, period. And there's no reason for us to persist in behaving as if the world is not privy to the news. You can look at BBC. You can go online and pursue other media outlets other than the watered-down news that we're given on a daily basis and find out clearly that we are simply not the country that we made ourselves out to be. These youth are not ignorant. The elder imam previously addressed Mos Def as being a legitimate voice. It's true. And look at what this brother is saying insofar as our foreign policy is concerned. It's very true that we should not be pursuing these angles of violence. However, as has been said by the elder imam, give us another angle. I live now in the Midwest. There is very visceral hate that's being exhibited towards the Muslim population. And for you to expect for young people to warm to the American sentiment is not realistic.
Tasmin, you put it very clearly and very well, and I appreciate your call. Imam Mahdi Bray, what do you say?
Well, I certainly echo Tasmin's sentiment that indeed there are real things happening. And we have to, another part of our initiative is what we call deen and deeds, meaning your faith and your deeds, keeping it real. And that's an important aspect with young people. They respect, you know, if you're keeping it real, if you're really being real, they can spot a faker a mile away. So I think that one of the things that we have to really do is keep it real and say, yes, for instance, I personally am opposed to the escalation of the war in Afghanistan. I think we are headed down the wrong road. And so are a lot of other young people, you know, not only within the Muslim community, but outside of the Muslim community. So by in keeping it real, you can say, yes, there are injustices. There's Guantanamo. There are fusion centers. There's profiling of American Muslims at the airport unjustly. There's a violation of our First Amendment rights, our 14th Amendment rights. All these things are happening. But do you want to, you know, keep it real, or do you want to play it stupid and spend the rest of your life in jail because someone, you know, gave you some hype and you fell for it? I always tell these young people that, you know, you can hear all this stuff, but the reality is, you know, if you move towards this, it's like a spider web. It's easy to touch but hard to get off your hands. You're going to wind up ruining your life, you know, possibly going and spending the rest of your life in jail. And we keep it real by saying, ain't no fun when the rabbit got the gun. So we really want young people to be able to at least realize that they have a right to address these things, but what's the appropriate way? How can you address these things without getting played by religious extremists and other people who have other agendas other than their well-being?
Imam Mahdi Bray in Washington, D.C., you also bring it very clearly, and we're grateful for that clarity today. Hope we can have all three of you back as time unfolds to see where this goes and how we're doing with it as a country, as a culture. Imam, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Tom.
Imam Mahdi Bray, Executive Director of the Muslim American Society Freedom Foundation. Juan Carlos Zarate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Alejandro Butel at the Muslim Public Affairs Council, government liaison there, based in Washington. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. You can continue the conversation at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.